It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Racial tension and conflict has always been a part of our culture in this country. Right now, the political climate has heightened those tensions, and hate groups, neo-Nazis, the Ku Klux Klan, white nationalists, and others have become more vocal and more visible. We all know about the violence that took place in Charlottesville, Virginia. Members of hate groups traveled there from all over the country. A peaceful protester was killed and many others were wounded when a member of these groups attacked the counter-protesters with his car. These events have shocked and horrified many, but they've also sparked an awareness that hate groups have members all over the country. This is not a Southern problem. This could happen anywhere. This hour, we'll talk about how to resist hate in your community, how to start positive conversations about race, and what you can do to promote a safe and welcoming environment at work, at school, and in your neighborhood. Leisha Brooks is here with me now. She is the director of outreach for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Hello, Leisha.
Good morning. Good morning, Charity. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for being here today. And one of the first things I saw after the Charlottesville, Virginia events was a lot of people were sharing a map that the Southern Poverty Law Center had created. And this was not a new map, but that they had created, tracking hate groups all over the United States of America. And this is something that the Southern Poverty Law Center has been doing for a long time. Have you seen a growth in these groups in recent years?
Yes, we have. We do an annual accounting of active hate groups in the United States, and the map you're referring to references 2016, whereby we name 917 active hate groups across the United States. Four, I would mention, in Iowa. We do expect that that number will increase in 2017 as it increased about 14% between 2015 and 2016. I would also add that the number of hate groups are increasing, as are the number of individuals who have become radicalized online and have no association with, you know, a physical hate group.
So people who are using this kind of hateful language, sharing it with others online, but have no affiliation?
That is correct. That's correct. There's a couple of just really disgusting online forums. One, the Daily Stormer, which is just anti-Semitic and racist. There's another called Stormfront that has over 330,000 registered users. So this information is being passed along online. And as I say, they have really no need to join an actual group in order to kind of take on these beliefs.
In the wake of these events in Charlottesville, Virginia, the Southern Poverty Law Center released a new edition of 10 Ways to Fight Hate, a guide for effectively and peacefully taking a stand against bigotry. And of course, a lot of people seeing these events were scared and horrified, but also felt helpless. If it wasn't happening in their community, if they are not part of an oppressed, so-called oppressed group, what kinds of things can they do? So in the face of that helpless feeling, let's talk about what individuals can do to stand up against these hate groups in their community. What would the first thing you would say be?
To act, to say something, do something. It is really important for each of us who loves, you know, this country and our democracy, to make a strong statement against hate, against white supremacy, against this push we see coming from neo-fascists. Each of us needs to stand up, whether or not we're directly targeted. It's targeting a kind of our country and our values. So it's important for people to just to speak that, to put that out there, to remind folks that there are more of us than there are of them. Kind of what happened in Boston in the aftermath of Charlottesville, there were 40,000 people who came out to take a stand against hate and intolerance, and they just, you know, drowned it out the other side, and it was a beautiful, beautiful thing.
There are people who say they thrive on this kind of attention. We can't give them attention. We need to ignore them. What's wrong with that idea?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that idea. The Southern Poverty Law Center really encourages people to organize kind of counter events. And that's kind of what we saw in Boston. It was in the same locale, but we really caution against and really tell people not to engage in direct confrontation with these groups. That's what they want, and that's how they create the spectacle. But it's fine to kind of have as happened in Boston. I mean, they were separate, they were loud, they were proud, but they weren't engaging back and forth, you know, verbally, let alone physically, with the organizers of that protest.
Now, again, in the wake of Charlottesville and in response to many other things, you know, a lot of people go online. The first thing that they do is go online and post something on Facebook about what they feel. And with the political climate in our country, we've learned a lot about the kind of echo chambers that we tend to live in online. So you could be just talking to people who all feel the same way as you. What are more powerful things, acts you can take in your community that do make a difference, other than just saying, hey, I don't think this is right?
Right. Well, start in your own kind of sphere. You know, you can start with your family. You can start with your friends. You can kind of articulate your feelings and begin to have some discussions with folks that are around you. You mentioned the internet and social media and how people kind of immediately go there to post their feelings. And then they may not even have a conversation with the person, you know, they're sharing a household with. It's important to kind of have these conversations, find that they're allies and people that support you. You might also kind of develop a different thought or opinion about what's going on. And in that way, we begin to connect again as human beings out in the real world outside of, you know, these echo chambers that you mentioned. And then we can work together and kind of work together to decide how we're going to stand together against hate and intolerance. There are all kinds of people, you know, we encourage people in faith communities, all types of faith communities, to develop an interfaith alliance to stand together against, be it anti-Semitism, which is definitely on the rise, or, you know, anti-Muslim, Islamophobia is on the rise. We can all kind of stand together as people of faith, if you're of a faith community, and say that we won't tolerate this. Not just when it targets us, but when it targets you, right?
When people respond to an incident like this, I think that there are some people who are afraid to speak out because they don't feel like they are part of the oppressed community. I'm a, you know, white 42-year-old Gentile mom. Mm-hmm. And I think some people feel like that it's not their place to speak out. So what would you say to that?
I would say, again, it is our place. We're sharing this space together. You know, this is our country. We're becoming increasingly diverse. We all have a part in it, and we've got to talk to one another about how we're going to kind of work this thing out. I would say to you, personally, you know, talk to your kids. Begin to talk about kind of what's going on. Help them as they kind of begin to navigate the world. We need to talk about the issues that confront us, race, racism, and everyone has a part in that. You can and should, you know, talk to your friends or colleagues of color and say, you know, this is how I feel as a white woman. This is how, kind of, you know, seeing white supremacists on the TV screen, you know, walking with torches, this is how it makes me feel. And, you know, and then hopefully you'll move to, and I can commit to you that I'm just not going to let that happen. You know, I'm talking to my friends about it. I'm talking to my kids about it. You know, this is wrong. So we can show support for one another in those kinds of ways. If we don't speak up, then, you know, as Elie Wiesel said, neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim.
There's been, I think, some confusion with people observing these events, wondering why these hate groups are allowed to speak out like they are. And I think there's confusion over what a person's right to free speech means and what constitutes a crime. And that's important to understand as well, right?
It is. It is. And, you know, one of the cornerstones of our democracy is the First Amendment, and the right that we have in this country, which is kind of unique globally, that we can speak our mind and our opinion, whether it's popular, whether people like it or not. You know, we as American people are free to say whatever it is we wish. Now, and that includes hateful, you know, kind of repugnant thoughts, bigoted and biased thoughts. You can do that. Now, there are very few restrictions on free speech. If there's a threat of imminent danger, if the speaker is calling, you know, speaking hateful things and calling on the crowd to, you know, jump on these people, then that, of course, is illegal. But there are very few restrictions on it. And what we have to do is, I mean, people have a right to speak bigoted thoughts. We also have a right to speak out against it. Judge once said, you know, the antidote to hate speech is more speech. You know, we have to continually counter that.
You talked about talking to children, which, of course, is an incredibly part of this education that we need to do in our country. Do you have some advice for people? When I was growing up in the 1970s, you know, we were taught to be colorblind. Oh,
sure.
You know, everybody's the same under their
yeah.
skin. But that hasn't
yeah.
been an effective approach.
Yeah. No, it's not. You know, and children, you know, they begin to notice difference when they're about 4 or 5 years old. And then it's just adults who kind of want to act like differences don't exist. Differences are not bad. You know, they're not inherently bad. We need to kind of talk to children about those differences, be it racial differences, religious differences, ability, kind of, you know, sexual identity, all of it. It's important to kind of just normalize those kind of conversations. As I say, we're in this together. One of the reasons why we see an increase in hate groups and hate group activity and people interested in it, and why this is such a fertile time for white nationalists to recruit young white men into the movement, because they use this whole thing of our shifting demographics and the browning of the United States and try to tell young white men in particular, you know, that they're under attack and they're going to lose everything. And, you know, multiculturalism and diversity is code for white genocide, and you're going to be displaced and we're being displaced, you know. So that I think makes it even more important for white families in particular to begin to talk to their children about what it means to be white, you know, today, and how whites are going to be, you know, it's true, you know, becoming a numerical minority in the country by around 2040 or 2035. Let's talk about it and prepare for it. Just as people of color coming from kind of marginalized or not marginalized, but minority communities, we talked about it too. So it's not something that strictly should happen amongst families of color, but it should happen across the board. And then our children will be able to talk about it because they'll have the language. And if we don't give them the language, especially white kids, that white supremacists will.
Leisha Brooks, thank you so much for talking with me.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about resisting hate in your community. I was just talking with Leisha Brooks of the Southern Poverty Law Center. In the wake of the Charlottesville violence, they released a new edition of their publication, 10 Ways to Fight Hate. It's a guide for effectively and peacefully taking a stand against bigotry. And this hour, we're going to talk about resisting hate here in Iowa, about how to start constructive conversations about race in our communities, about what we can do to make sure that our schools, our businesses, our neighborhoods are safe and welcoming environments. With me now is Lakeisha Johnson. She's Assistant Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer at Grinnell College and Associate Professor of Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies. Lakeisha, hi.
Hello. How are you doing, Charity?
Great. Welcome back to the show.
Yes. Glad to be back.
Katie Swalwell is also with us. She's an associate professor of education at Iowa State University. Hello, Katie.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. And Lakeisha, I want to start with you. Just tell me, when you learned and saw what was happening in Charlottesville, what was your reaction?
Well, I was horrified that someone died. I mean, obviously, but because of all of the recent instances of people being shot by police, and we've just been inundated with these violent occurrences. And so for me, knowing that it was a Nazi or KKK rally of some sort, it didn't surprise me that it got violent. So I don't know if it's that I'm just maybe some of us have become numb to it. When you see it, it's like, oh my God, another one, you know, another incident. And you know, at the core of it is this racial hatred or racial bias. And so, I was horrified that someone was killed. But I also, it didn't really surprise me given the climate that we're living in right now.
These hate groups have become much more vocal, much more, I guess, brazen in mm-hmm. in their in being outspoken, in showing their faces. I mean, this has certainly mm-hmm. been something that we've seen increasing, especially in the last year or 2 years, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I think that people feel that it's okay to take the mask off now. And, you know, what that reveals is that these issues were just at the surface waiting to come up. And so it's something that as a country, we just have to address head on. We have to deal with our past and the ways in which our country has aided and abetted the very behavior that we're now protesting, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it's out there and in public, but the truth of the matter is that it's always been there. That doesn't mean that we can't do something, but I just, you know, people should not think that this is like a resurgence or something new.
Right. And you live in Iowa now, which it's not where you grew up. Iowa, as we all know, has historically lacked in racial diversity, although it's become increasingly diverse in the last few decades. You work at Grinnell College, which is sort of considered to be a bastion of liberalism, but also not a hugely diverse community, Grinnell, Iowa. How does that change your view when you view what's going on from here in the state of Iowa?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know if it really changes my view. I do think that as a campus, because we've been very vocal about our commitment to diversity and inclusiveness, and because we have a very strong non-discrimination policy, we have a hate crimes and bias-motivated incidents policy, I think that you become comfortable, you know, within the confines of the campus. I came here in 2008, so, you know, this was probably the most open and inclusive place that I've ever been a professor at. So for me, it was like, wow, this is different. But the reality is, you know, we understand that there are people beyond the campus who don't necessarily agree with the beliefs that we've sort of put up, or not beliefs, the values that we've put forward as a community at Grinnell. But then again, there are also people in the town of Grinnell who are very committed to the principles of social justice, principles of equity, inclusion. And so, you know, for me, living in Iowa, I think I try to focus more on that. That's not to say that it doesn't bother me that, you know, I see trucks with the Confederate flag on it, or, you know, it doesn't mean that sometimes our students aren't confronted by people who say racist things or homophobic things or, you know, just horrible, you know, shout horrible things from the car or whatever. And so basically what we try to do is to control our environment as much as we can, and then to support our students, faculty and staff, should they experience something, you know. And again, it could be something very small or it could be something more serious, but we hope that the more serious things don't happen.
Well, and we're going to get into facilitating constructive conversations about race on a college campus and everywhere in just a moment. Katie Swalwell, I want to give you an opportunity. Now, not only are you Associate Professor of Education at Iowa State University, you have done a lot of research about the history of race in the state of Iowa and teaching about the history of race in the state of Iowa. And I'll give you a chance to respond. I mean, what was your initial reaction to the violence in Charlottesville?
Yeah, I think Lakeisha's point about not being surprised, I also was unsurprised and horrified at the same time. I think the turn that events took afterwards with counter-protests and demonstrations, while it was wonderful to see a lot of people rise up, one of the pieces that troubled me the most was a hashtag that came out, #ThisIsNotUs. And I really understand the impulse to distance ourselves from white supremacy and really blatant ugly, explicit racism. But just as Lakeisha had said, this is us. This is our country's history. This is our state's history. And really coming to understand and have a sort of reckoning that this is us. And maybe a better hashtag would be, this is not who we want to be. But really sort of taking stock. It's not a resurgence. It's nothing new. It's tragically a very old strain in our country's history. And so, yeah, I think I was horrified and depressed and also, you know, just on a human level, just sort of heartbroken about what happened. But I certainly wasn't surprised.
And we've talked about this on the program before as we've looked at race in the past in Iowa. We like to congratulate ourselves as a state. At least a lot of progressives like to congratulate themselves that Iowa has been a very progressive state and there are some things in our history that we should be very proud of. Mm-hmm. But you have also pointed out that Iowa has also participated in this structured, systematic racism in the past. I mean, that was part of the founding of our state, right?
Yeah, exactly. There have been some really amazing, really cool stories that Iowans should be really proud of that came about primarily because of really concerted efforts of people of color who were organized for generations to make change happen. And really what changes they were trying to make were responding to the way that the state was established. So when the state entered the United States, the Iowa Territory became a state, there was a constitutional convention. And I have a quote here in front of me that I share in presentations about the history of anti-Black racism and white supremacy in Iowa, that in that original debate about the state and how it should be set up and what the policy should be, what the rules should be, what the sort of initial problems were that the state needed to face, their first challenges, one of the big conversations had to do with slavery. Iowa entered the Union as a free state, but I think for a lot of us who grew up here, we were taught we were one of the good guys, you know, the South with the bad guys. But really, those early conversations were really spun off from this quote by Ed Longworthy, who was a delegate from Dubuque to the Constitutional Convention. And forgive my language, but he said, quote, "If we had not something to keep them out, we should have all the broken down Negroes of Missouri overrunning us." So that was really the common sense among the legislators at the time when our state was founded. We bordered Missouri, which was a slave state. And so what can we as a state do to keep things white? So they looked to other northern states and they passed a series of what was called the Black Codes, which institutionalized segregation very clearly. So Black people could not serve on juries, could not serve as witnesses, couldn't serve in the military, couldn't vote. Interracial marriage was banned initially. Black children were not allowed to attend public schools. So when that's how our state was founded and the institutions, that's the DNA of our institutions. That's something that we really need to keep in mind and think about how that there's a lot of lingering effects even when we pass laws to pull some of those Black codes away.
Well, flesh that out a little bit for me, because mm-hmm. It's really easy to say, hey, that is part of the past and that is unfortunate and we should be ashamed of that, but mm-hmm. we've moved beyond that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's not the law in the state of Iowa now. Why is it important to know that and come to terms with it?
Sure. I mean, a bunch of different reasons. I think first, when we look at history, something I like to remind my students in teaching them how to teach social studies is we have to remember that when a law was passed or an event happened, it's not like everybody, you know, blinks and they change their mind, that these ideas linger for a long time. And even when something is illegal within people's families, they're still often teaching or practicing those same habits of mind and just habits in the world. So if we look at, let's say, discrimination in stores and movie theaters and restaurants that was going on in Iowa for many, many, many decades, then by the 1870s, there was a law that was passed that said that you can't do that anymore. There was a Supreme Court ruling. Well, it wasn't until 1949 that there was the first successful case against using that ruling to say that people cannot discriminate. So even though you had a law on the books for 70 years, the practice of discrimination still continued and the courts, the police looked the other way. So that's a long time to teach white people that the laws on the books don't really matter, and that the what matters most is the practices. And then even if we think about 1949 being the first time that those laws were enforced, you know, my grandparents were certainly alive during that time. My parents would be born shortly thereafter. So these are, when you think generationally, and the ways that we influence each other, these are not events from the far, far distant past. These are ideas and practices and habits that people have cultivated for generations, and it takes a really long time to get rid of those. And I think the work that the Southern Poverty Law Center is doing is one of those efforts to really try to address how people think about these issues, how they talk about them, and what they believe.
And before the show, Lakeisha, we asked you to share some articles, some things that people could read to really further these conversations. And one of the things you shared with us is about understanding white privilege, which is something that we hear people talk about a lot right now. White privilege can be really difficult for white people to understand because it's not something that you feel. Oppression is something that you feel on a daily basis. Privilege is something that it's really easy to take for granted. So what do you feel like people need to understand about white privilege?
Well, I think that what people need to understand is that this is not about labeling someone a racist. This is not about explicit behaviors. This is about a system. It's not really about the individual as much as it is about a system that has developed over time that basically privileges one group while at the same time oppressing another. And so even if you disagree wholeheartedly with racism or sexism or homophobia, if you are part of the group that has benefited from oppression, then you have privileges that, first of all, you don't even recognize sometimes, right? I mean, it takes being aware. And then after that, you know, asking yourself, okay, in what ways can I, as a person who is white, who benefits from white privilege, what can I do to make things better? You know, what can I do to mitigate the suffering of others? I mean, and not in a paternalistic way or anything like that, but just to say, you know, are there moments when I'm, you know, in a room with all white people and someone says something that's really racist, you know, do I speak up? You know, and sometimes people do, sometimes they don't. And there may be really good reasons for not doing it at the moment, but again, I think this is what the challenge is with understanding privilege. And it doesn't have to be race. It could be gender. It could be sexual orientation. It could be disability. And as a GWSS professor, I mean, we've been teaching Peggy McIntosh's white privilege article for a really long time in intro classes. And what's really great about that article is that she, as a white person, goes through lists of things that she doesn't have to worry about because she's white. So, you know, she doesn't have to worry about someone following her around the store because they're afraid that someone like her will steal. This isn't the case anymore, but back then she said, you know, I can go to the store and pretty much know that I can find a Band-Aid that's the same color as me. You know, just little things that you just never think about. And that's I don't want to say beauty of privilege, that's the sad fact of privilege, that it's unconscious, and you're unaware of how you're benefiting. And so you have to learn more about how the system works.
It's something that people can get incredibly defensive about.
Oh, yeah.
when it's brought up, because I mean, there are a lot of people that if you bring up white privilege, then they feel like you are calling them racist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, I've taught the Peggy McIntosh article, I mean, I almost every few years or so, there's always somebody who, I don't know how they read it that way, but they immediately assume that a person of color wrote it. And then it's like, no, you know, this person is actually white, and she's thinking about these things in very critical ways. And so, yeah, I mean, sure, people will get defensive, but I just think that there are a lot of people, once they're aware of it, are at least willing to consider that maybe, in fact, they have benefited from it.
And even if that awareness doesn't necessarily lead to action, do you feel like that affects some kind of change, just that understanding?
Yeah, I mean, in the same way that, you know, we've been seeing a lot, and we do a lot of work on our campus now around issues of implicit bias. So, I mean, being aware of power, being aware of how power works, how privilege works, you know, the history of those things in this context, you know, is really important. But also thinking about the everyday things, everyday practices that we all engage in as humans, because we are biased. We are learn to make associations about certain groups that are just fed to us. We don't even realize that we're getting these messages. And so when you, I think for me, you know, being an African-American woman who teaches around these issues, one of the things I like to emphasize is, okay, you realize that, like, everybody has bias. It's like a part of being human. The question is, what do you do when you are aware that you are behaving in a way that is discriminatory or that is, that preferences someone who's more like you? What do you do to stop yourself? What do you do to say, okay, I'm not going to participate in this system because it's unfair and it's not based on reality or truth? And so, yeah, I mean, it's something we all struggle with. I really recommend visiting the doing the implicit association test.
Let's talk about that in just a moment because we have to take a short break.
Oh, okay.
We'll be back. Lakeisha Johnson is with me from Grinnell College and Katie Swalwell from Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about what you can do to resist hate in your community. We're talking about how we can start productive conversations about race in our communities, with our children, with our families, with our coworkers. We're talking about what we can do to promote safe and welcoming environments at work, at school, and in our neighborhoods. You're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Lakeisha Johnson. She's Assistant Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer at Grinnell College and Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies, Women's and Sexuality Studies at Grinnell. Katie Swalwell is here, Associate Professor of Education at Iowa State University. And Lakeisha, just before the break, we had been talking about understanding white privilege and how that is difficult for a lot of people. And then we started talking about understanding our own implicit biases. And we all have these implicit biases, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think once we realize that this is a human phenomena, and that, in fact, in order to make our way in the world, in order to survive in the world, we learn to make certain associations. And so, you know, the classic example that the New York Times used, and it has a nice series about implicit bias, one of the things they say, if someone says peanut butter, at least in this context, within the United States, you might think jelly, right? And you would unconsciously associate those things. And so I think once we start to become aware of those places where we might be treating someone unfairly because they're different than us, or favoring someone because they're like us, then we have hope in terms of trying to change our behaviors. And again, I highly recommend the implicit association test. You can just Google that. It's on the Harvard University website.
Right, and we'll share that link when we put up the web post later today. I've taken a bunch of those tests. It is fascinating.
It is fascinating.
And enlightening to take those tests. I want to ask you one more. This is a more personal question, Lakeisha. One of the things that I keep seeing online in conversations about race following, police violence and brutality, or following the Charlottesville violence and attack, people saying, hey, don't make your black friend explain to you why our culture is systematically racist. And, you know, we invited you on the air, of course, as a chief diversity officer at Grinnell College. But
absolutely.
I'm also making my Black friend Lakeisha explain how this works. So, I mean, give me a little bit of insight on that. We need to do the work ourselves, right?
Absolutely. And I have white friends. I mean, we want to talk about that. I mean, I've been on the show before, but I think what I most appreciate for people in my life, people who I've grown to love and respect, regardless of color, what I look for is somebody who's willing to look at themselves and to someone who's brave enough to stand up when their Black friend isn't around. You know, again, when they're in one of those spaces where, you know, something really outrageous is said and it's all people of the same group, you know, we can, right now we're talking about whiteness, being able to speak up and also being willing to pick up a book or, I mean, nowadays you can get so much information on the internet, although a lot of it you have to be careful with because you want to make sure it's accurate. But I think doing the work, doing the hard work yourself goes a long way. And then I think having genuine relationships with individuals who may or may not be the same color as you. I think people appreciate just having a human relationship with someone before they start asking, you know, weird questions, you know, weird questions or, you know, what can I do? It's like, go read a book, you know, but see,
right.
if a close friend of mine asked me something like that, that would be bizarre. Like that just, that those are not the people that I surround myself with. They would know better than to ask me that. And I could say to them, are you kidding me, really? Because we've developed a friendship that goes beyond the categories that we fit into.
Right. But yeah. It's not the responsibility of your Black or Jewish or Latino mm-hmm. friend or acquaintance to educate you. I also want to ask you, as a Black woman, this is a reality you've lived with your entire life. You drive long distances. You know, there are always moments mm-hmm. when I'm sure you feel vulnerable, when I think all minority people in the United States feel vulnerable mm-hmm. because of their color. At this moment in time, do you feel more scared? Do you feel more vulnerable when you're pumping gas at a gas station or something like that?
Not when I'm doing that, but I do think driving long distances can be, you know, both not just as a Black person, but as a female, you know, driving long distances and hoping, you know, do I have enough gas? You know, I hope the car doesn't break down, that kind of thing. I think the thing that's, for me, the most troubling, like I said, because this is something that Black people and that I've experienced all my life. So for me, you kind of, again, you kind of get used to the fact that you have to be aware. But I think the thing that's been the most challenging for me has been the issue of police brutality and particularly the case of Sandra Bland. I think when she was found in the cell and the whole thing came out about how she was pulled over and she was on her way to a job at a college, I work at a college, mm-hmm. and I hadn't yet heard the video I was listening to the radio as I was driving home, and I was driving quite far, and I listened to the exchange between her and the cop, and I just started bawling. Like, I just could not stop crying because I was just like, oh, my God, that could be me. And, you know, that's a sad statement that it happens so often in our country that I would actually be afraid of a law enforcement officer pulling me aside, even though I am a law-abiding citizen. You know, I mean, I have nothing to hide. But the fear, yeah, it's there. And it makes me mad that I have to deal with it, but it is what it is. And I think the more we speak out, the more people from a variety of backgrounds challenge profiling, practices of hate, all of these different things, the better we'll be.
We're talking about how to resist hate in your community this hour. With me, Lakeisha Johnson, Assistant Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer at Grinnell College, also Associate Professor of Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies. Katie Swalwell is here, Associate Professor of Education at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. And Katie, we talked a little bit about having conversations with kids, how, you know, talking to kids about race early is important, early and often. the whole colorblind approach has not worked historically, still does not work. But a lot of us also need to have these conversations with other people in our families. If that's, you know, our spouse, if it's our brothers and sisters, cousins, parents, or grandparents, how do you start these conversations?
Yeah, there's a great website, and maybe this is a link you could post as well, Raising Race Conscious Children. It's raceconscious.org, and they have a lot of conversation starters, like even sentence starters or little scripts almost to follow when you are starting conversations with people that you aren't sure where they might go, because that can be scary, especially if it's people we really love and they're going to be in our lives forever, that, you know, you might tread more lightly. But in my mind, those are the people that are absolutely the best people to have these conversations with when you do have that layer of love and you can't be so dismissive. You're really committing to having those conversations over the long haul. So I would really recommend that website. Also, just reading. I think, you know, the advice Lakeisha gave to pick up a book is great advice. There are so many wonderful resources online. One of my favorites is the hashtag Charleston syllabus from the African American Intellectual History Society, and that's available online. So sometimes when you're entering into those conversations, having read something, having watched something, that can be a touchstone, or even asking someone to read something or watch something with you can be a launching pad to have conversations that can dig a little bit deeper, and then just sort of set the stage that these are things that you want to talk about, that you're open to talking about. Sometimes the first conversation might not go the way you want it to, but it can plant the seed for subsequent better conversations. So be patient with those talks as well.
You compare this to talking about sex ed. This can be uncomfortable for a lot of people.
It can, yes. And just like sex ed, if we don't talk about it, really bad things can happen. So, you know, I think that, you know, starting young is really important. We know kids, even as young as three, are developing racial identities. And something I really stress with teachers especially is it's not enough to just talk about race and to talk about how we've all been kind of put into these boxes. You know, and it's based on different skin color, and to celebrate that and not be afraid of it. That's important. But we also have to talk about racism and how it operates and how it works, what implicit bias is, thinking about the media we consume, the events that we attend, where we choose to live, who we seek out for friends. Really, we need to prepare kids to be conscious about all of that, to have a critical consciousness about race, so that they're thinking about racism as well as race. And probably the biggest takeaway I would encourage listeners to do, especially those who are parents, is to reach out to schools and teachers to ask what they're doing to teach about these issues. The number one thing my teacher candidates say when we're launching them into the world is that they're really scared of parent pushback. Even if they're excited about teaching these things, if they feel prepared and to do it professionally and responsibly, that is something that still scares them, is that there's going to be pushback. So the more parents that speak up and share that this is just an expectation they have, they want teachers to talk about this, they want their kids to learn these histories and to think about these issues, learn how to talk about these issues in a respectful, loving way, that will make teachers feel so much more comfortable, will make schools seek out teachers that want to do that. You know, that will be an expectation they have. So the more parents or community members that share that desire with schools, the more likely it is that it will happen with young people.
And you're not a diversity officer at Iowa State University, but as a professor at Iowa State University, that's a campus where there has been some conflict.
Yeah.
And there were white nationalist flyers handed out on campus last year. So tell me about the conversation about race on campus at Iowa State University. How can that be facilitated at this charged moment?
Right. You know, there were even racist posts a week or two ago. I mean, this is an ongoing, really frustrating challenge for the campus. I think there are a few things that can really help. One thing that helps is when the top leadership is sending very explicit and unequivocal messages that this is not tolerated and that we want to be a safe space and that we're an anti-racist space. So the more that, you know, school officials can send that message down the ladder, that is really, really helpful. And then there are lots of grassroots efforts bubbling up among students, among faculty, to try to push these conversations in the open and to devote resources towards them. And I will tell you, it's not easy. You know, even in departments with faculty this is their expertise, this is what they think about, this is what they study, you know, not all of our colleagues do. And it isn't that they are against it, but if it's something that you're not familiar with or if you haven't thought about it a lot, you know, there can be defensiveness or nervousness, anxiety around talking about it. And something that I think we're trying at our college is to really build relationships, not as the end itself, but as the means to an end where we have more equity, we have more safety, we have more justice for our students. So the more you can reach out to your colleagues, be in relationship with them so that you can have conversations that are uncomfortable, that's really helpful. There's also great resources. A book that I highly recommend people read is Courageous Conversations, which directly addresses how to talk about these issues with people that may be nervous about them. So lots of great resources and really great efforts, even when it's challenging and there's setbacks and it can be really frustrating.
Chris is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you want to add to the conversation?
Well, you know, one of the things here in Iowa, and not just in Iowa, but also in the U.S. of A here, we have not dealt with racism as people to see how people feel about racism and discrimination as continuing. This is 2017, and we're still dealing with the same issues as our ancestors was dealing with back in the day. You would think, yeah, we've came a long way, but we still have a long way to go. And when you have, like the young lady just said just a few minutes about leadership, part of the problem is leadership. When you have leadership, like we have this so-called president that we have, that is okaying this kind of behavior and letting this kind of behavior to the mindset of the racist individuals, is let them feel that they are okay to feel the way they feel, and you can act out how you feel, and that's okay. But then if an individual, a person of color, fights back because of this racist mindset individual is trying to do something to that person as far as hurting them bodily, trying to hurt them or any kind of way, a person has to fight back. And so when you have police and stuff, when they come in and they're just going to arrest everybody because some folks have to defend themselves because you have individuals that are trying to do bodily harm to them. At Charlottesville and all that had happened there, you had racist individuals walking up and down the streets with AK-47s, with pistols, shotguns, and everything else. Now, what in the world do you think would have happened? Let's flip the script.
Right. And Chris, I'm so sorry that we are out of time there. But Katie, that echoes what you were talking about earlier, that we have to understand our history. We can't teach civil rights as if it's over, as if that's just a part of the past. And we have 30 seconds left here. But one of the things that has been very concerning to me is to see people cutting off communication with people who disagree with them in this environment. And Lakeisha, that seems like the wrong way to go right now, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, as an educator, I think that we have to promote spaces where people can have really honest, difficult conversations about these things. You know, it's not going to help anybody if we refuse to talk to each other. Now, obviously, I'm not suggesting you go run out and find your local Nazi and have a conversation with them. I'm talking about situations where we can create safe spaces for the dialogue.
All right. Lakeisha Johnson, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Lakeisha Johnson, Assistant Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer at Grinnell College and Associate Professor of Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies. Katie Swalwell, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Charity.
Katie Swalwell, Associate Professor of Education at Iowa State University. We will share many of the resources we've talked about today on our web post at iowapublicradio.org later today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.